It's the Buyer Beware edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a whole show dedicated to Boxing Day, or put another way, the psychology of shopping. Let's begin episode 320.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, as Boxing Day approaches, I thought we'd devote a show to consumerism, more specifically the psychology of shopping. As many listeners may know, I'm somewhat of a communist at heart. That said, some people find it surprising that I not only like capitalism, but believe it's required. It is a necessary step of social evolution. Capitalism creates the means of mass production that will necessarily lead to the revolution to our glorious communal revival. It was, in my humble opinion, a lack of an industrial foundation that caused the failure of the previous iterations of communism. A failing China seems to have overcome. We can now go to any grocery store or department store and find an abundance and variety unimaginable a century ago. It's the paradox of plenty that has led to the wasting of billions of pounds of edible produce and the like because it doesn't meet our acquired high standards. The paradox is we here in Canada et al. Throw out about 20% of the food we buy, while the poor here in Canada are unable to afford nutritious food, not to mention the millions of people starving around the world. We produce more than enough food to feed all the people on Earth. We just choose the distribution system, capitalism, that values profits over people. And of course, we have another paradox. When we enter our favorite grocery store, we have dozens and dozens of choices of food items to pick from. Different flavors, makers, some are low fat, others low salt, this one's kosher. There's so much choice. Which product uniquely matches your taste, your needs, your personality? With the bombardment of choice, with so many things to consider, we experience what is called the paralysis of choice. That is, with such variety, it becomes impossible to choose one. We iterate the value of flavor, the ingredients, then the health status. Is this one ethically made? Then back to flavor. All this mental activity wears us down. And that, according to some psychologists, is sort of the point. By expending so much mental energy in making a choice, the importance of price diminishes, and we end up paying more than we might would have otherwise if the choices were simpler. This was not the case a century or three ago, when most things we made ourselves, and every article of clothing was truly a unique creation. For those things we couldn't craft ourselves, we had to enjoin a craftsman to build a table or gun or what have you. These goods of minimum production meant there was a degree of scarcity and increased cost, but we knew two things. They were well made, for the most part, and they were unique works of art, if you will. The phrase, the table was handcrafted and passed down through centuries, has been replaced with the slap together, let's go to IKEA to get a new one. Of course, as I said, to feed and clothe the multitude, to create the material excess we currently have, things were lost, and the increase in choice coincided with a decrease in value, both economically and emotionally. Now, one of the tenets of capitalism is the idea that there are many companies competing for the consumer dollar, and this has led to the cornucopia of choice. After all, capitalism is predicated on competition. That is the driving force of progress. And of course, this is now a fallacy. Here's another paradox lying at the heart of choice. Actually, there are not many companies making those vast array of products. In fact, most supermarkets, fast food places, electronics, and other doodad brands are actually owned, produced, and distributed by an ever-decreasing number of corporations. So although you may think there are 40 companies making those 100 different brands of salad dressing, based on the brands you see on the shelf, in actuality, there are only 4 major companies accounting for 2/3 of the salad dressing market. This concentration of production, juxtaposed a faux diversity of brands, was best exposed with the sad dogopolypse of 2007, when it came to light that dog food was adulterated by melamine, an organic compound toxic to dogs. This led to the demise of many a pooch, as well as a recall of almost all dog food. Why all? Well, it turns out that Menu Foods was the producer of almost all brands of dog food. If not directly through their own brands, they were subcontractors who made brands for third party. In fact, after the debacle of 2007, Menu Foods was acquired by Simon Pet Foods, which boasts on its website that it makes over 35,000 SKUs of pet food. The appearance of great diversity, but one megacorp behind it. So one of the fallacies of capitalism is that competition leads to diversity of production, when in reality, it leads to monopoly. But to you and me, you still get that paradox of choice. To recap, the choice paradox works against the consumer because when faced with such a monumental number of choices, we are not as concerned with prices, so they get us to spend more. Inflating prices is another manipulation, and this can work three different ways. The first one, I'm not as troubled with because it tends to affect people with too much money to begin with. It is a curious thing among a group of people. Okay, this may be a bias among most of us, but only a few of us can indulge in it. That is the value of value, in that we are predisposed or perhaps trained to think that if something costs more, it must be better. If we're offered a sample from a $10 bottle of wine and then from a $100 bottle of wine, we will almost always say that the more expensive wine is better, even if, via experimental trickery, the two bottles were actually the same bottle of wine. We have been conditioned by our capitalist society to assume that the more something costs, the more valuable it must be. So the more expensive product must be better. Alas, if only it were true. There's been research, and yes, anecdotal evidence from my mom, that a product that sold for $40 in a boutique, well, it didn't sell at all. But when it was displayed in a different area and the price was increased to $70, suddenly it flew off the shelves. What happened? This sort of reasoning by the consumer placed more value on the item at the inflated price because the inflated price implied that it must be a more desirable possession. And as such, it made it a more desirable possession and people bought it. Well, it seems we have the belief that you get what you pay for. And sometimes this is true. But this heuristic has been hijacked by, how shall I say, elitist marketers? Apple. And the irony is that on the low end of the scale, this strategy does work. If you buy a laptop computer for about $300, it will be slower, more prone to defects, and not last as long as a $1,300 laptop. But part of the reason for this price sensitivity is the actual level of competition. There are actually a lot of independent companies making PCs, well, Windows PCs. So thanks to competition, the price and quality more or less correlate. However, in most markets, like the dog food example, there is actually little real competition. And there are some brands that have created a cultish following, like Apple, Bose, or Nike. Regardless of the actual quality of the product relative to its competition, these companies have managed to, how shall I say, brainwash vis-a-vis advertising, creating a quote brand, which induces people to spend more money on the product, irrespective of its objective worth. But then again, if you're willing to spend upwards of $500 or more on your headphones, have at it, my elitist friend. You have way too much money anyway. Another aspect of manipulation by price inflation, unlike the inflation we just talked about, is the sort of bait and switch. That is, a product, say some electronic, is listed at the manufacturer's suggested price, or MSP, of, let's say, $800. And a company displays it for that price. But then it goes on sale for $400 with the tagline, say $400. The only problem is that product itself was never intended to sell at the manufacturer's price. It was always a $500 piece of equipment, as in the cost to make it was at that price point. But by inflating its regular price, the seller can claim a huge discount, and the buyer gets the impression, if not the reality, of getting a great deal. It's amazing how much people want to feel like they're reaping a huge saving, if not that saving is illusionary. Still, that doesn't mean the product is bad, only that it is as good as it is at the sale price. It is a good $400 PC. And for some products, like computers, as I've said, price can be a good indicator. There are, of course, more ways to manipulate prices to encourage purchasing than you can shake a stick at or something. Another retail trick, No, trick's not the right word. Manipulate, yeah. Another way to manipulate buyers is to create a false wingman. For those who aren't sure what a wingman, look it up. So what do I mean by a wingman in this scenario? Well, if we go into a store and a bread maker sells for, I don't know, let's say $100. We look at it and we think it would be nice to have, but it costs so much. Maybe I can just keep buying bread from where I usually shop. But now you put that same $100 bread maker next to a $200 bread maker, the wingman. People now say, wow, that $200 bread maker is great, but I can't afford that. But the lower priced one is looking better all the time. And it would be nice to have fresh made bread. Our internal justifications then jump in. And ultimately we think that an effective compromise is no longer to just keep buying commercially baked bread, but to buy the lower priced bread maker. This is called the compromise effect. Retail for the win. Now many people think that sale events are a great way for consumers to get a great deal. As already mentioned, most sales are not real sales, as in you get what you pay for. Even those great Boxing Day sales are not as great as you may think. In days of yore, Boxing Day was a chance for companies to offload the products they couldn't sell pre-Christmas. But now everyone knows that Boxing Day is just sort of part of the hype. Instead of discounting stuff they didn't sell, merchandise just gets held onto until the next sale period. Which is like every week, sales are always going on. But they're useful hooks to bring consumers into stores. Now the items advertised as great deals are specially brought in products. A large outlet goes to a manufacturer and says, we want a product with this specs and this price. Make it happen. And because of the huge purchasing powers of stores like Walmart, it happens. That doesn't make them bad purchases. And at this time of year, volume does help. But you are not most likely getting the same $1,000 food processor at a $500 price point. It was made to be $500 processor. Companies do not sell products at a loss. Well, okay, perhaps a small percentage, but only if they know they can make it up by selling other products. A practice of selling at a loss is called a loss leader. This is where a company will actually sell, and this time I mean literally sell in the literal sense of the little word, at a loss. So maybe they do sell a food processor at half its price, for reals. But almost always these products are limited, as in 3 to 10 per store. Their purpose is to get you in. By the time you actually get there though, because of the limited quantities, they're usually gone. But you are there and you still need a food processor, so you end up getting the $800 unit. The company makes a 90 profit. C'est la vie. Of course, as I hinted at just now, there's always a sale going on. Every week, every store. It's just what product is on sale this week. Okay, that's part one. There are always sales, but they're hard-ended. That is, if it was on sale Thursday, you cannot get the sale price on Friday. Plead all you want, but they will say no. But why so, hard-ass? Well, one, the sale may be subsidized by the manufacturer. That is, a company like Kraft might tell a grocer, let's say Save-On, if you sell 1 million Kraft dinners this week, we'll give you a rebate of 10% of the cost. Or to move more product, HP may offer a 15% discount for this week, which is great news for the consumer, but bad news for your psyche. The day after the sale, people will ask if they can get the item at the sale price advertised last week. And the retailer says no. Just not no, but a loud no. Again, why so harsh? Partly is the economic deal between the supplier and seller, as we just mentioned, but mostly it's psychology. When this happens to you, your brain tells you, well, next time, don't delay, act fast. Don't think about whether it's a good or bad buy, just buy it and get the deal. We are being conditioned to be impulse buyers. Consistently, we are being conditioned to not think. If you don't buy it now, it will be gone tomorrow. And thus, we give in to impulse. You might also see this manipulation to condition buying when a big discount is offered, but only if you make sort of a minimum purchase. And of course, none of the product itself necessarily. Buying bulk can seem a logical reason to give a discount. For example, if you spend $100, the price of a Christmas turkey goes from $5 to $3 a kilo. Or we're encouraged to buy in multiples of a minimum of 3 or more in order to get that sale price. The reason why? The result in bulk purchasing, buying more than you need. Obviously to condition you to buy more. especially when you get into the habit of loading up on those mega-sized shopping carts in use these days. Another device intended to increase shopping. You get to the checkout and the cashier points out that the turkey deal you were in there for, well, you actually didn't get any turkey. Sucks to be you, I guess. Anyhow, on that note, we're going to pause and take a break, and we'll be back after this message.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, your best bulk buy for the holiday season. And we're back. Another way retailers will use psychology to get more out of you is to offer special discounts, easy terms, only if you apply with their special credit card. They know from extensive research that in-store purchases increase sales by hundreds of dollars if you have a store credit card, even if it's a branded Visa or the like. And don't get me started on those loyalty cards. Why does this work so well, you might ask? Well, credit card money is not perceived as real money. Well, not in the "I'm really a trumped up animal in people" clothing. When we buy something and actually have to give paper money to someone, we feel that as a loss. We resist that. However, when we slip a card into a Transelect and punch in my special numbers, well, it's all virtual, make-believe in a way. I don't get the real-world sense of loss. We're willing to spend more because we literally feel it less. Okay, so there's also a number of ways that marketers have used our biases against us. For example, it seems men are more likely to think prices in red are a bargain. Women, not so much. And what makes it crazy is that studies have shown that men are less price sensitive to some products than women. In fact, if men are given time to think about a purchase, they are less affected by the signs written in red, and like women, actually suspect that red signs may be a marketing ploy. According to Nancy Puccinelli, who co-authored "Are Men Seduced by Red? The Effects of Red versus Black Prices on Price Perception," published in the Journal of Retailing, women process information in retail in a much more in-depth way than their male counterparts do. In a set of experiments, researchers discovered that when men saw an advertisement with the prices written in red, they believed that the retailer was offering greater price savings than those printed in black. Not only that, they felt very positive about making such purchases. For women, it not only had little to no effect, it actually made them suspicious. According to Puccinelli, quote, "If you show a woman an ad in red, the woman is skeptical of what is really going on and thinks she has to be extra vigilant. Am I getting tricked?" she might ask herself. Men are less practiced shoppers, and they see red as a more useful shortcut. Now, before I get emails and call-ins about the sexist statement, we are dealing with generalities here. Not all women are all men. And we do live in a sexist, gender dimorphic society where women are assigned or expected to perform certain tasks, like shopping, and men, not so much. I would interpret the comments not as sexist, but realist, at least in the current society we live in. To reinforce this interpretation, the study goes on to say that women also seem to have far more accurate recall of prices in advertisements than men, with Puccinelli saying, "It could simply be that men are not motivated to think deeply about an advert, so they don't process them in depth, or don't care. When we told men that they have to pay attention, the effect of the color red went away. Motivate them and make it important, and they are much better shoppers. Keep in mind, we were just talking about how stores want us to think less. Well, there's many ramifications, few of them good for you shoppers. Another weird bias I came across is we have a preference for products on the right. Go figure. In a study published in 1977, Richard Nesbitt and Timothy Wilson published a paper about post hoc reasoning. Post hoc, for those non-philosophers, is the act of essentially making up an explanation later for an action for which the person actually does not know the real reason for doing said action. A classic example is a corpus callosotomy. That is when the two sides of the brain, which are connected by the corpus callosum, and in people with severe epilepsy, this connection is split, and each side of the brain no longer knows literally what the other side is thinking. An often observed side effect is post hoc. Why? Well, to varying degrees, each side of the brain is specialized in various functions. For our point, one side is responsible for speech. Each side tends to dominate the other side's sensory inputs. In our case, the right side sees through the left eye and vice versa. So via experiments, when a patient thusly split is presented an image only visible through the right eye, the word smile, and to the left eye an image of a face, the patient's asked to draw what they saw. They would inevitably draw a smiling face. When asked why a smiling face, they would say things like, "What, you want a sad face?" Another example, they are shown two images. One to the left brain, let's say a shark, and the right brain saw a car. They were then asked to pick out objects related to what they saw. Inevitably, they picked out a car and a shark, one from the left hand, one from the right hand. They were then asked to explain why they picked out these objects. They said, "Well, I saw a shark on the screen." And then they made shit up, because the left brain literally had no idea why they picked the car, it not being able to see it on the screen. And that is when post hoc was used. People would say, "Well, you need a car to escape a shark," or "You're going by car to a Chinese restaurant to eat shark fin soup," or something. The point being, post hoc is our internal mechanism to explain our actions or decisions that we made, at least on a conscious level, that we have no idea why we actually made them. So let's return to that 1977 study. The researchers presented consumers in a discount store with four pairs of identical nylon pantyhose displayed side by side on the table. The participants were not told that they were identical. To ensure there was nothing different in the actual iterations of the pantyhose, the location of the four pairs were rotated so as the pairs were not always in the same position. The consumers were asked to select the pair of pantyhose that they thought were the highest quality. Upon making the selection, each consumer was asked to explain why they chose the pair they did. Consumers gave sensible responses, focusing on attributes such as strength, elasticity, sheerness, etc. But remember, folks, all four pairs were identical, and the consumers were significantly more likely to select the pair farthest to the right, regardless of which one of the four identical pairs was actually in the far right position. Significantly, the proportion of respondents who prefer the pairs from right to left were 12%, 17%, 31%, and over 40% thought the one on the farthest right was superior, demonstrating a statistically significant positioning effect. None of them offered position as a reason for their selection, even though it must have been. Why would they? Unconscious bias is beyond our rational grasp. When asked directly if position influenced their choice, only a single consumer conceded that the position was a factor in their position. And that was a subject who was actually a psychology student who had learned about cognitive biases. So he was kind of in on the gag. The point of this being is that retailers are using cutting-edge psychology to discover our innate biases, right-handedness, color preference, other sensory stimulus, including light and aroma. Yes, some high-end shops smellify their shops to induce more spending. And it goes deeper. If you look back a couple or 6 years, there was a worry that real brick and mortar stores were going to be a thing of the past, that online was a future of retail. Well, welcome the return of the big box. One thing Amazon and all forgot is that we value things on our hand far more than things in our head. That is, we want to go into a technology store like the former Future Shop and touch and try out a TV before we buy it. In fact, that's actually a psychological trick, that we value something more in our possession, even if we don't legally own it, but simply touch it, as in a demo in a store, then we do something that is somehow more academic or ethereal, like online. We are tactile creatures. And that is why physical shops are experiencing a resurgence, because they are melding the big box, hands-on experience with a variety of online shopping. And why Amazon, yes, Amazon, is starting to open up brick and mortar shops. The psychology behind this is that we value loss more than gain. That is, if it's in my hand, I have it. Our monkey brain says, it's mine! And so to give it back to the salesperson seems like a loss. Well, declining to complete shopping now in our online virtual shopping cart, well, we don't care so much about that. That is why retailers are quick to put a product in our hand. They want us to hold it, examine it, use it. It's practically ours. All that's left now is that little business of paying for it. They know once we touch it, have the impression, however ethereal, that it's ours, we are far more likely to want to take it home with us. After all, in our monkey brain, it is ours. We must take it home. That also leads to another reason why salespeople present merchandise add-ons. Every store offers services, extended or enhanced warranties. When they present these, they will use terms like you get, but more often you will hear the, if you don't get this, you will lose the use of your PC. The great color clarity we promised in this TV will be lost if you don't get that color calibration. Final analysis or point is, if you don't get what they're offering, you're going to experience loss, and we hate loss. And the emphasis on loss is not accidental. We all love free cable, or an extra $30 off, but we hate the idea that we may lose the value of our purchase if we don't also buy into the enhancements that will so supposedly add to our purchase's performance and appearance. That if we don't buy in, we will lose everything. And again, we value loss more than gain, oddly. I'll return to that dollars off later. But another bias we have is for front-facing numbers. That is, if a product is $45 versus one that is $44.99, we perceive the latter to be more than the penny that it's actually different. A better buy than the former. Even though in a rational frame of mind, it's only a penny. And pennies don't even exist in Canada anymore. Again, on one level, we all know this is true. But we are animals. And as such, we like to pretend we are not. And those primal instincts are still working. Don't you think a corporation would like to get that extra penny if it thought it could? No, billions are spent every year on research to tell them that we, at a base level, are simple, and that we think 24 is smaller than 25, regardless if it is followed by the number 99 or not. And that priming is not only limited to the 99-cent pricing. Have you ever wondered why some stores will have specials like 10 for $10 or 4 for $4? Why not just say one for a dollar? Well, they're priming you on how many you are expected to buy. I think the ad would sound something like this. Hell, at that price, why not buy a whole passful of them? Or stock up while they're at this price. Or these are so cheap, you can buy twice as many as you need. You kind of get the picture. The point being, until they said buy 10, you might have only wanted 5. But now that animal brain is saying, buy the big number, it must be better. And we post hoc our way to the cashier. There's been a lot of research that shows being personable pays. Getting to know a person's name and using it repeatedly will create a quote connection. The buyer thinks, if only subconsciously, that you're their friend, that you can be trusted. Small talk turns into being a helpful, knowledgeable confidant and not a salesperson. Nothing is sweeter than to hear your own name. So when it comes to recommending a product, there is trust. Even though there's no long-term history, but you glean information about them, their name. And a good salesperson would click onto the details, like hobbies, likes, dislikes, their favorite movies, sports, activities, and utilize this information to establish a connection. Again, these are generalities, but a good salesperson will take these snippets of biography and use them as justification for buying whatever it is they're selling. There have been studies done with regards to tips for servers that something as simple as a touch, in an appropriate way, that a simple touch on the shoulder or arm can lead to an increase of 10% or more in their tips. Now, as our loyal listeners know, I think tips are evil, but the science is firm. Another tactic that has overtaken retail sales is the shift from self-serving commission sales to problem-solving associates. In the days of our parents, the idea was that working on commission would ensure the effectiveness of the salesperson. Well, the thinking was, if an opportunistic salesperson ripped off the customer, they wouldn't be trusted. They'd lose sales and perhaps their job. So it would, by necessity, be better and more productive salespeople. However, as communities grew and commission schemes become more complex, the relationship between good customer service versus, let's use an overly sharp but not completely inaccurate phrase, good service versus ripping off the customer for personal gain became hazy. That said, non-commission has a dark side. It is the assumption by the customer that if a salesperson is on a commission, that is, if you know a salesperson makes no money off of your purchase, you are more likely to view them as an honest broker, that they have your interest foremost, or at least less likely to push a more pricier product on you. Well, less likely than commission sales, but there still is a pressure on the staff to promote high margin. For those not in the know, high margin means high profit. There's an understanding between employer and employee of certain undertakings and outcomes. A fine balance is maintained, resulting in a ride to work, or if not, the unemployment office. And again, it is what it is. Capitalism taking from the worker and giving to the bourgeoisie. Another trap, but perhaps one that does offer a kind of reward for the shopper, are the bargain bins. Say a big box has an assortment of DVDs, or maybe books or sweaters, where you dig through to find that special hidden treasure, and it's 75% off. As previously mentioned, the sale price you are paying is in most cases the cost of production. So those plush toys that were regularly priced at $100 that you can now buy, if you can find one in that big old bin of toys for just $15, well, it was likely always $15, costing the company maybe $5 or $10. Very seldom will a business sell an item for below cost. In the rare cases that this does happen, from time to time the bargain bin is full of merchandise they couldn't actually sell because the packaging is missing or it's ripped. Sometimes, in the spirit of old school sales, it is something that has actually been kicking around for a few years and they just can't seem to get rid of it. And sometimes the item is damaged, usually cosmetic damage. These can be seen as real deals for the consumer. But then again, it is kind of akin to buying secondhand. And it's yours, good, bad, or indifferent. That said, bargain bins add another hook, the excitement of the hunt. This is most evident with auctions. The participants get caught up in the game, the excitement of the moment, and you end up spending more than you actually intended. But paradoxically, you're jazzed that you won. And like in the case of the bargain bin, you found that treasure, something everyone else seems to have overlooked, and you got that copy of Mavis Beacon Teaches Typing. Sure, it's version 3, which was released 7 years ago, but it used to sell for $50, and you got it for a buck. Woohoo! Another hook with bargain bins, because you've digged through that entire box, searching for that deal. Well, in your mind, conscious or not, at a certain point, you feel like you have to get something. You spent quite a while going through all that stuff. You don't want to feel like you've wasted your time. So you grab the blooper reel of Waterworld. You didn't really want it, but it is 50% off. Along with bargains, there are other hooks, like free samples offered by grocery stores. Or perhaps while at the big box store, there's a demo of a drone. Maybe they have a clip of the latest blockbuster playing on a TV somewhere. They got your attention and you stop. And when you do, the store wins. Okay, sometimes samples are used to trigger impulse buying, but their main task is to distract you. Studies have shown the more distracted people are, the less price sensitive they become. This means that when you are entering a store, you have a purpose to make a purchase. You have an idea of the cost. Okay, let's judge the options. It's that latter part that gets hijacked. As you are distracted, you become more risk tolerant. In the context of grocery shopping, you are willing to spend more money on the kale-flavored Womp Rat because, well, you've never had it before, and yes, it's twice as expensive as the chicken-flavored Womp Rat that you intended to buy, but it's kale after all, the new wonder food. Let's take that risk and try something new. Okay, not likely Womp Rat, but that was my sort of homage to the new Star Wars movie, so let's move on. Another Jedi mind trick is to use bad service to sell more. As counterintuitive as that may seem, now on one level, from personal experience, people are different. Like, duh. That said, some people don't want to become your friends. They just want the facts, no filler. Now to me, this isn't rude, but efficient. It can come across as brisk, sterile, maybe a tad impolite, but a good salesperson will adapt to the client. That said, there's being brisk and then there's being rude. In research done right here in UBC, it was observed for luxury items that the ruder the salesperson, the more people spent. So what do I mean by rude? Are we ignoring people or slapping them on the face? Rude is a very vast topic. So in the study, when a salesperson brushed off a customer or they ignored their attempts for service, the consumer's perception of the value of the product increased. The harder it was to get, the more prized it became, i.e. they were willing to pay more, as well as their desire to purchase more. It seems that, according to the researcher, the luxury sales snobs, as the press release calls them, it creates a kind of in-group. Think high school clique. We want to belong, and if that means working harder to show that we really want that product, you are willing to spend more to show that desire. And the stores are more than willing to use your evolutionary bias against you. They also point out that being rude in general doesn't actually work. When they applied this technique to major brands and the like, the expected reaction, being put off, was the result. It also showed an interesting skill. It seems that customers could tell when someone was an authentic snob or not. And if that clerk themselves did not, quote, fit in, if the salesperson didn't meet their expectations of the right kind of snob representing the brand, they would be marked as a poser, and the rudeness would be seen, as again one would expect, as just having bad manners. And on that note, let's take another break. We will return after this message, if you're worthy.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
I knew I had a problem.
I tried counting calories, eating and eating.
Nobody else could possibly understand.
We understand. We're Overeaters Anonymous, and we have helped thousands of people stop their compulsive eating and start living a healthy, rewarding life.
With OA, I am living again and loving it.
Start living the life you deserve with help from Overeaters Anonymous. Find us on the web at OA.org.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, the luxury brand of skeptical programming. And we're back. Another trick that first appeared in trendy overpriced restaurants was the dropping of the dollar sign. In a study out of Cornell, three types of menus were tested. One with the prices in numbers preceded by a dollar sign, one with the prices sans the dollar sign, and one where the numbers were written out with the word dollars added at the end. Psychological theory would have predicted that the written out price would show the least price sensitivity, i.e. they would spend the most. That is, words are not processed in the same way numbers are, and that numbers and price sensitivity would be correlated in our brain. Swap the numbers for the words, and you sort of short-circuit this pricing mechanism. But in reality, it was the one in numbers without the dollar sign that short-circuited our brains. The study controlled for party size, dining duration, tipping behavior, and individual table variation, and found that people would spend about 8% more if the dollar sign was absent. Now, I've been aware of this technique in restaurants for a while, but while researching the show, I suddenly noticed that in the local big box electronics store, there wasn't a lot of dollar signs to be seen. Now, one might assume that some nefarious corporations are employing an army of psychologists to trick us, and that's probably true. But if that were true, one must wonder, when I went on that very same store's website, all the prices did have dollar signs. You would think that if it was a plot, that the site would also be sans dollar signs. I suspect some parts of our psyche are intuitive, and one department changed because they thought it was a winning strategy, while another thought that they should be formally correct and keep the dollar sign. And then again, if you do have an army of psychologists, there may be a deeper method to this madness. Side note, the longer a person is in a store, the more they spend. Those stores that have eateries in them or other conveniences, the same study showed that the longer you stayed in the restaurant, the more money you spent, which again seems intuitive and explains why one-stop shopping, aka the big box retail, have become the dominant form of retailing. I mean, really, superstores sell shirts, and why are there Harveys at Home Depot? Okay, another paradox of retail is when less costs more. And this happens in several different ways. First is when we, indirectly, are asking to pay more for less. Notice, for instance, that Coke now comes in advertised 90-calorie cans. That's down from 140. Or Mars bars that now have 10% less calories. And of course, you would think that was great. These big corporations really care about our health. They reformulated their product to make them healthier. Well, not so much. While they, in theory, led to reduced caloric intake, more on that later, this is often achieved by simply reducing the size of what you're getting. Those Mars bars are not made any differently. They just reduced the package from 58 grams to 48 grams. But you know what they did keep? They did keep the price. Well, we're used to the price, and why confuse the shopper? And although in the case of the Coke, there was a price reduction, but it was not proportional to the reduction of the serving size from the traditional 355 milliliter to the new mini cans having 255. If you do the math, you're actually paying more per milliliter. Now, one could argue they're making more money per package, but in the end, it will cost the consumer less. If you normally drink a can of Coke with lunch, and that can has less calories because of the size, well, that's a win for me, no? No, not always. Two things tend to happen, at least with a Coke. You're thirsty. You need, let's say, 300 milliliters to satisfy that thirst. And one can used to do the trick. But now you're left wanting. So you need two cans of the mini Cokes instead of one of the old standard cans. As you're doing the math, that actually means you're drinking over 500 milliliters of Coke, so you're actually ingesting more calories as well. And even worse, human psychologies work against you. If you have one of those 100 calorie mini bags of chips, you think to yourself, I'm winning the war in weight. In fact, you've been so good eating these itsy bitsy teeny little mini bags, what harm could there be to have a second one? And again, any potential health benefits are gone. The only one who wins here is the producer, who not only has managed to get you to willingly, perhaps enthusiastically, pay more for their product, but you are more likely to consume more of that product than before. Although along the same lines as the previous ploy in marketing, this one is not flaunted. In fact, this one happens constantly, but with no new advertising or hoopla. It's sneaked in through the back door and goes largely unnoticed. You may have noticed, actually more likely you haven't noticed, that Cheese Whiz now costs 10% more than it did a year ago. Bacon has risen 25%, according to my calculator. As I said earlier, you may not have noticed these increases. Cheese Whiz hasn't gone up, and you're sure you're paying the same for bacon. So what the hell am I talking about? Well, that is true, the prices have stayed the same, but the package size has been reduced. In the case of Cheese Whiz, it went from a kilo to 900 grams, and those 500 grams of bacon are now sold as 375 grams. Although I've chosen to highlight the above product, it is a trend that has been accelerating over the past few years. Producers know that people are sensitive to pricing, but we're not really that great at math. We don't have the time, nor do we have the will to keep track of every package size for everything we buy. It looks the same, the price is the same, it must be the same, and we fall into another trap. So far with junk food, there seems to be a heads up. Things are changing. But the stealth price increases seems, I don't know, somehow more slimy, somehow dishonest, if only morally. Included in the less cost more theme, we have another trick that, as someone sympathetic to environmentalism, is not only misleading but harmful to the environment, and that is overpackaging. Okay, it's not dumping oil into the Gulf or anything, but when you buy a box of cereal and you realize that half of the box is empty, that's a lot of wasted resources, resulting in more garbage. And why? To make you think you're getting a bigger bargain than you really are. Again, our primitive instincts, bigger is more, means that if they sell you a box of chips that's this big, we think we're getting a lot. I mean, look at the size of that box. But when you open it up, it's only this big. We don't get the reality check until after we bought it, open it up, and seen what's inside. That's when we know we've been played. So why do we keep playing this game? Psychology. One of the most frustrating facts about biases is we are unable, or at least extremely hard, to ignore or counter them. Even when we know they're at play, they still work. And when you have stores that are actively diminishing your mental energies, we talked about distraction, choice, and other ploys earlier, knowing something intellectually does not often translate into smart purchase, and the capitalist knows it. Okay, there's another way we get what we asked for, and it's not always what we thought it would be. I often joke that we forget about the extras, that when you buy a car, you're often reminded that tires are extra. Extra? How can you drive a car without tires? And yet, they are an accessory. Check the car price list next time you're in a new car lot. It lists the accessories, and everything has a price, including the tires, along with the choice of fabric for the seats. I remember back in the day at the local Radio Shack, you sold a home computer for about $3,000. Ouch! But it was a complete package. They threw in a printer, joysticks, software, and they would guarantee its parts for like 5 years. But consumers said they wanted it cheaper, and producers took heed. Now a piece of technology sells for like $500. You want a printer? That's extra. Software? All extra. Want us to warranty that purchase for 3 years? That's going to cost you. And oh, and by the way, we sell advertising on your system, so it will be slower and constantly nagging you to buy this or that. We can get rid of that, but that's also going to cost you. Like airlines, everything costs extra. Sure, the prices come down, but the cost is still about the same. I think it's about time I wrap this up. And at the risk of repeating myself, as the biggest sale event of the year rolls around, Boxing Day, I want to leave you some advice. In the olden day, Boxing Day was the day retail sellers tried to flog off what they couldn't sell pre-Christmas. Not anymore. It is the most anticipated sales day of the year here in Canada. And as such, they are no longer trying to get rid of excess stock. They are bringing in merchandise specially for the day. And as such, I want to remind you, as my loyal listeners, you actually do more or less get what you pay for. To illustrate this, and I think I remember this, but it holds true for other things, if not just this one. I remember one of the large retail chains were advertising a Boxing Day sale on waffles. Regular $50 on for just $10. Wow, what a deal. The belief was, and if I may foreshadow my own point, we were led to believe that a waffle iron that was regularly sold for $50 was going to be on sale for the ridiculously low price of $10. We were supposed to think that Walmart wanted to get rid of the excess, even if it was losing $40 a unit because of accountancy or something. Well, rarely will a company sell anything at a loss. Yes, we've discussed lost leaders earlier, but those are almost exclusively limited in number. There were lots and lots of these waffle irons. This is a psychological ploy based on our primitive animalistic biases that work every year. You see, what likely happened was Walmart went to the waffle iron maker and said, hey, listen, we want a waffle iron that does all the things the $50 model does, but we're only going to pay you $9 for it. You make that happen, and yes, we'll buy a feckload. The manufacturer goes back and says, well, if we build a feckload, we could reduce the cost maybe from $50 to $40. How are we going to get it down to $9? Well, the simple answer is cutting. Where? Who knows? Cheaper plastic, less consistency in the heating element, less quality control. Something as simple as changing the manufacturer's warranty from parts and labor to just parts. The point being, you are not getting a $50 waffle iron, you're getting a $10 waffle iron, which, if you like waffles and can't afford a $50 waffle iron, great for you. Just remember, you get, at least to a point, what you pay for. I hope you all feel that you got what you paid for in this episode of Radio Free Thinker. I should plant a seed that we will be soon heading into Pledge Week here at CITR. If the spirit of Sagan moves you, please feel free to send in a donation to the station, or at least remember this public service announcement when the pledge drive is on. I hope I can count on your support. It is listeners like you that help keep programs like this on the air. Wishing you all a happy holiday. This is Don saying eyes open, minds engaged, and hearts rich with giving. And yes, just for you, Mom and Dad, Merry Christmas.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truth.
Send me. We are at a time in history where we can change the world. What do we want to pass on to future generations? That we just stayed here on Earth, that we didn't look out to find out where we come from and are we alone? No. We want to pass on this joy, this excitement.
When a nation dreams big, everything falls into place.
Beyond the horizon, over the next hill, that's where we make discoveries.
That's the next frontier.
It is in us to look farther and deeper. It's deep within us. That is why we are all here. Over the next hill, beyond the horizon.
Dream of tomorrow. Wander the open seas, call for this adventure. Dream big, dream big, dream of tomorrow. Wander the open seas, for the open seas.
There are lots of huge frozen worlds caught beyond Neptune. Huge frozen worlds. Seek out these other worlds. Other worlds.
Audacious visions have the power to alter mind states, to change assumptions about what is possible.
Beyond the horizon, over the next hill, that's where we make discoveries.
That's the next frontier.
It is in us to look farther and deeper. It's deep within us. That is why we are all here. Over the next hill, beyond the horizon. If we are to discover life on another world,
it will change the way everyone feels about what it is to be a living thing in the cosmos.
Is a virus alive? Is crystal alive? Does life need this? Does life need liquid water? Is a virus alive? Does life have metabolism? Does life need...
Life need.
This is a virus alive? Is crystal alive? They're asking these questions.
Working together, I claim we can
change the world!
There's a just tremendously exciting prospect called solar sailing.
And it works exactly as an ordinary sailboat does.
It takes you to where you want to go. It's a whole new kind of idea. It travels on the wind from the sun. It takes you to where you want to go. It's a whole new kind of idea. It travels on the wind from the sun.
Dreams prevail in the citizens' ambitions.
It is time to set sail for the 21st century.
Beyond the horizon, over the next hill, that's where we make discoveries.
That's the next frontier.
It is in us to look farther and deeper. It's deep within us. That is why we are all here. Over the next hill, beyond the horizon.
That's the next frontier.
It is in us to look farther and deeper. It's deep within us. That is why we are all here. Over the next hill, beyond the horizon.
Find your place in space. Space is vast and unexplored. There's a lot of work to do.